as the darkest hours at 500 to 950, and in his book the section begins with page 266 and it goes on to 377. So it's a big chunk. And as I mentioned before, try to read as much as you can. Break it up. Read a while. He speaks of this as the darkest hours. This was a period when, in a sense, it, for a time it looked questionable whether Christianity might even survive, at least naturally speaking, it looked this way. It was a time when there were some losses instead of some gains. So he calls it the darkest hours as far as the Christian church is concerned. And before we get into that, I don't think I gave you any information on Patrick, who really belongs to this section just before this. Now, his dates are about 440 to 493. I didn't go over Patrick, I don't think, did I? Okay. And he's, of course, connected with Ireland. He was the son of a deacon, grandson of a priest, and he was born in Scotland. And he was carried captive to Ireland when he was 16. And served 6 years as a shepherd. As a slave. They had slaves in those days. If you were captured in war, you just became the property of someone else. And he was converted while tending sheep. Perhaps because of his childhood teaching, he really turned to the Lord. He escaped to Great Britain. He was enslaved again. And then he had a dream, like Paul, where he really felt a call to go to Ireland. He felt a call to go back to Ireland, spread the gospel, and he devoted the rest of his life to Ireland. In his outlook, he was Catholic, he was Orthodox, he was sort of ascetic in his views. He kind of stressed independence of the Pope, and he recognized Scripture as his only authority. Only basic authority. And he was very zealous, very wholehearted, and there was a tremendous movement through Ireland. In less than 100 years after Patrick, Ireland was covered with churches and convents and monasteries. He had a tremendous impact there. And he had a tremendous emphasis on monastic learning. And when on the main continent of Europe, a lot of learning was really at an all-time low. You had monasteries in Ireland that were keeping on studying the word and learning the languages and really applying themselves in their study. So that Patrick here, of course, is always connected with Ireland. There are all kinds of myths and fables, and it's hard to know just how many, you know, are true or not. But there's no question what he had a tremendous influence in Ireland. Patrick. So he's one we want to think of before we get into this next series of events. Now during this period, you have the breakdown of the Roman Empire, while that's being completed. Remember we talked about Rome was captured and plundered in what year, or about what time, do you recall? 410, alright, good. And this really shattered the faith in Rome. Before this time, Rome was the symbol of power. It was viewed as being impregnable. It was the symbol, you see, of the unity and stability of the Roman Empire. It's no longer that anymore, and you have these waves of barbarians coming down from the north and northeast. And they kept eating away at the edges of the Roman Empire. And as they would attack and come in, they would be sort of assimilated. These various invasions from the north. 476, the last Roman emperor was deposed. and the center was then, from that time on, Constantinople. It was really the end of the Western Empire. And we'll mention this later, but as a result of this, now the Pope came into even more prominence. He no longer had an emperor in the West. And as a result, the Pope became very strong and increasingly stepped into the breach that was left by the fact there was no strong civil government. And the church, under strong popes especially, became very, very strong. In 496, you have Clovis, the king of the Franks, being baptized. And you have some of these German tribes turning to Christianity. And you find Christianity then becoming strong in those German tribes. Now, one of the big events of this period was the Islamic conquest. And I think maybe I'll read the life of Muhammad now. And next time, you remember, we hope to have a Muslim from Saudi Arabia here to talk about Islam. And I'll just go over some of the things here in connection with Muhammad, just some factual information. He was born about 570, and he died in 632. And of course, he grew up in Arabia. He was born at Mecca. His parents were poor. And he made just a bare living by guarding sheep and goats. He was illiterate. He probably could not even write. The knowledge he had, he picked up by ear. Good listener. He'd listen to conversation. He'd have books read to him. Now, I suppose he made a wise move when he got married. He married a rich widow at 25. As he was 15 years older, she had previously hired him to carry on her business. And I guess he liked her business, and he married her. Her father opposed the marriage, so she got him drunk until the ceremony was completed. Now, the business prospered. They had six children. Only one girl lived, though. Her name was Fatima. And later on, he married many wives that caused him trouble. And scandal. He had violent fits. Some have thought he was epileptic, which he at first traced to demon possessions, and later he decided it was divine power. And his wife encouraged him in this. She really believed in him. And it sort of got him going along this line, that he was a real prophet of God. God would take control of him. And he was gripped by this idea of the divine unity. God is one. And some of the Christianity that he saw, I think, kind of repelled him too. All of this talk about Mary, the mother of God, and to Muhammad, God was a great power, a great being, and some of the kind of, well, gross ideas that maybe some of the common so-called Christians held, just didn't appeal to him. How could God have a mother? So that he stressed the idea of divine unity and the greatness of God. And he also believed very strongly he was a prophet of God. He believed in 610 he received the call of Gabriel to be a prophet, and his wife encouraged him. And he began having these revelations, as they're called, until he died. He preached to his family and friends for 3 years. He had 40 converts by then, and he started doing more public preaching, and he especially attacked idolatry, fought idolatry. And he began producing the Quran, which is, of course, the sacred book of the Muslims. In 622, and this is an important date, He was persecuted, and he fled to Medina, which is 250 miles north. And this flight, or hijra, really marked the beginning of his success. We often think of this as the beginning of Islam, because he was really accepted in Medina and began to progress even more. In 624, he began the conquest by the sword. He began to organize the people, and they would conquer by the sword. They would extend their territory. And in 630, he came back to Mecca and destroyed idols. He died in Medina in 632. His last words, as they're recorded, are these: "The Lord destroy the Jews and the Christians. Let his anger be kindled against those that turn the tombs of their prophets into places of worship. Gabriel, come close to me. Lord, grant me pardon and join me to thy companionship on high. Eternity in paradise." Now, he had different successors, and these were called caliphs. They were like, well, I suppose you'd say emperors, rulers. Now, let's think just a little bit about, you know, his personal character and his teaching. He lived simply himself, lived in a small cottage usually, ate mostly dates and water. And he was glad to help with domestic duties. He was very much given to passion. His favorite wife said the Prophet loved three things: women, perfumes, and food. He had his heart's desire of the two first, but not of the last. He was a poet. The Quran is an Arabic classic. And he was a very emotional man. He could have real highs, and then he could have times of depression. Very emotional in his makeup. Shaf says of the Quran, "It has many passages of poetic beauty, religious fervor, and wise counsel, but mixed with absurdities, bombast, unmeaning images, low sensuality. It alternately attracts and repels and is a most wearisome book to read." Shaw says about it. Now, in the teaching, what are some of the teachings of Islam? What are some things that stand out to you as you think of Islam? Maybe you could, if you speak up so we can get it on the tape. What stands out? If you think of Islam, what do you think of? On the teachings. Gary?
One God.
One God, alright. The unity of God. Allah is God. There's one God. Allah is His name. And this God was a very arbitrary, despotic God. Very different from man. Remote. Remove an absolute control. He has ordained all things, both evil and good. And so along with that, of course, there's a predestination. Allah wills it. A fatalism. If something happens to you, Allah wills it. And along with this, resignation is viewed as a supreme virtue. Be resigned. Accept what comes. Don't fight it. Allah wills it. Prayer, fasting, and alms are essential to heaven. It's basically a works program. And along with this, not certain foods are forbidden. Pork and wine were forbidden. Polygamy was encouraged. It's kind of a mixture here, isn't it? In some ways it's aesthetic, but in other ways certainly not. But only four wives were allowed for the ordinary believer. The caliph had no limit. And you could have any number of concubines you wanted. Really, traditionally, in Islam, there's a question whether women even have a soul. So a woman is basically a piece of property. Now, I'm sure this has been moderated a lot in thinking in, you know, this modern age, depending on the country. But woman was basically for the enjoyment of man, a piece of his property. Heaven is a place of sensual delight. It said that there were to be 72 virgins to every man. Slavery was sanctioned and war was commanded against unbelievers. And the Quran, of course, is the holy book. And since it's more recent than the Bible, it displaces it. You read the most recent thing, Muhammad is his prophet, is the prophet of Allah, and therefore, of course, you want to read the Quran. Now, Islam, after he died, under the caliphs, the Arabs really spread, very rapid spread. And we'll just run over some dates here to give you an idea of the way they began to mushroom out and their control spread. By 651, they had conquered Palestine, Syria, Mesopotamia, Persia, most of Egypt. Very rapid spread. And we'll note a little further some of the more precise dates concerning this. Maybe we could just notice some of them now. For example, 638, they took Jerusalem. Yeah, as the Arabs are spreading in their conquest. 638, they took Jerusalem. 641, they took Alexandria in Egypt. In 650, Mesopotamia and Persia. Parts of Asia Minor and North Africa. Then in 697, they took Carthage, which was a tremendous blow. That gave them the north of Africa. 697. See how they're spreading now. In 715, they were up in Spain, and they had moved into India and into Central Asia. They were reaching out that far. So you can see the tremendous spread in less than 100 years. The tremendous spread here of Islam. And as they moved in, Christian communities began dying in these areas. They put terrific pressure on Christians. For example, Christians were taxed. You could be a Christian and could exist. But you had additional heavy taxes placed on you as a Christian. You could not do any evangelizing. For a Muslim to turn to Christianity, to become an apostate, was to make him liable to the death penalty. And of course, any people involved in it. So that there was a community could only survive, a Christian community could basically only survive by having children, you know. You could do no evangelizing, which of course has marked Christianity, this keen concern to evangelize and spread the word. This was just throttled by Islam. And then they put pressure on in different ways. No new church buildings could be built. Church bells couldn't be rung. This would disturb the Islamic community. In many areas, many places, they were required to wear a particular badge or distinctive clothing so the Christians stood out. They were marked people. If you wanted to get ahead in government, no use to really be a Christian. In most cases, now there were exceptions, but preference was given to those who followed Islam always. So that there's pressure being put on these communities. And in the areas now that they held, and some of these areas, you see, had been, they were involved, the birthplace of Christianity, and places where you had very strong Christian communities. You had Antioch, you had Alexandria, you had Jerusalem, and these areas all through here, now, that are in the iron grip of Islam. And the little Christian communities are struggling, they're trying to survive, they're trying to carry on, and they did for some time. But they just became kind of little, I suppose you could say, encapsulated communities. They couldn't grow, they couldn't spread, they had kind of a defeatist mentality. They were just trying to survive, they tried to pass it on, maybe sort of like Jewish groups in some of the ghettos in Europe, under times of real pressure. You think of under Hitler's regime and things like this. They had tremendous pressure. So it was a time when Christianity here was knowing terrific pressure over a period of year after year after year after year after year. And it meant that in many of these areas, Christian communities just began dying out. This is one of the reasons, you see, he speaks of this as the darkest hours. Because here was an area now throughout Asia Minor and down along the coast there to Jerusalem and all right around the Fertile Crescent there and right down to Egypt. It had once been just the birthplace of Christianity, and here it's in the iron grasp of Islam. And these little communities are just constantly intimidated. So it looked black. It really looked black. And you remember, the Arabs just kept spreading and moving on until, I don't know how well you remember your history, but anyway, we speak of it as the Battle of Tours in 732 when the Franks stopped their advance. They were just moving on up into Europe. On past Spain and just moving right on up. And putting tremendous pressure there on Europe. But in the providence of God, they were stopped there, and then they began to be rolled back, gradually a little at a time, at least, out of Europe. But a tremendous conquest here, you see, of an area that had been Christian for years. T-O-U-R-S. So this is one of the reasons for that we speak of these as dark years for Christianity. Now you also have other invasions. You have from 500 to 700, you have Slavic tribes moving into areas north of Greece. Moving down from the north and moving down there and pushing Christianity, or Christendom, back. Asserting themselves, and you have Christianity regressing in those areas, not making progress. But you did have progress in other areas. We just quickly touch on a few things here. In the 8th century, you have the conversion of much of Germany. This would be during the 700s. Most of Germany is brought under the control of Christianity. Now we don't say it was all, you know, legitimate conversion. A lot of it in those days especially, it would be a ruler deciding to become a Christian. Sometimes, like Constantine, you wonder whether his motives are political or just what all is involved. Maybe he thinks there's some truth in Christianity. Maybe in some cases he was genuinely converted. But at any rate, then he gets baptized, and he may even pass the word out. You know, I'd like to have all of you baptized. And in some cases, they would just, he would command the army, you know. We want every man in the uniform to be baptized next Sunday. March into the river, and we'll have a bishop say a few words, and you'll all be Christians. And so it was kind of wholesale conversions. If the head of a country would accept, then usually, at least the country as a whole would go that direction. Trip.
Well, in China at the Great Revival when whole armies were being hit, was it the same thing as it was during this period? Are you familiar?
I'm not sure what you have reference to there. And I don't, yes. But this is the way a lot of the so-called evangelism was done. The goal was to get the head of the state to decide to become a Christian. And once he would do it, why then the whole country would tend to follow him. It was sort of the state church idea. And of course, with the stress there was on baptism, how are you born again? It's the water. Put them in the water. And, or sprinkle water on them. But it's the water that does it. And you want to become a Christian? Of course, you have to agree outwardly and be willing to go through this. But it just became kind of a routine ritual. And you went through this and you were a Christian. And of course, that just led to all kinds of abuses. Well, in the 9th and 10th centuries, you have the Frank Empire breaking up, and we'll touch on this a little bit more in detail, and you have the invasions of the Scandinavians, really hitting down the north of Europe. They plundered, they destroyed churches, they wiped out the monasteries in Ireland. And it was a terrible thing for Christendom. So-called in those areas. These Scandinavian invasions, they really swept. They swept right down into Paris. They even, and this was kind of interesting because we were in Europe last summer, they were even in Pisa. They captured Pisa in Italy. And they really held a lot of Europe in terror. I don't know if I'm proud of that or not. My ancestors came from Norway, but anyway. This is what happened. They were pagans and lived by the sword. And as a result, the so-called Christian communities were intimidated and in many cases wiped out. They just go in and they just plunder everything their monastery had and terrorize the people and kill half of them and haul the women off, and that was it. And so it was a time of reverses. The Arabs are attacking, and the Arabs during this time even attack again and moved up towards Sicily. They took Sicily, took the southern part of Italy, and you have them threatening again. So that during this period of time, it just seems like Christianity is being just put in squeeze. From the south and the east, you have the Arab invasion. And from the north, you have these different pagan groups, heathen groups, tribes coming down, and the Scandinavians finally just sweeping down in there and wiping out big Christian communities and this sort of thing. And so it was a time of real stress there for at least, we can say, the outward church. Now, during this period of time, you really have a division of the church into the east and west. And we want to look at that a little more, because before this time, you do have the Catholic Church, as it's called. By this we mean universal. And you had doctrine pretty much being accepted throughout much of it. But in the West, who was the strong patriarch? Who was the strong man of the West? All right, the Bishop of Rome, the Pope. He was the strong man. Now, in the East, you have several patriarchs, don't you? You have Alexandria, you have Jerusalem, you have Antioch, and you have Constantinople, which really, because it was the seat of the emperor, was the dominant one. It was the strongest. But also, in some ways, although it was the seat of the emperor, this led to weakness. Why did it mean there would be weakness in a situation like this? All right. The church would be united with the state. It would tend to be dominated, wouldn't it? And this is what happened. The emperor there, because he was close, would tend to dominate. He wanted to control the church. And historically, the emperor had, you know, in connection with the heathen religions, had claimed to be the high priest of the whole system of worship. And in connection with the church, he took the position here of certainly not being subject, at least. And depending on the emperor, some of them were very strong, and they attempted to control more. Others of them allowed the bishops and the patriarchs to do more of what they wanted to. Now, the bishops in these cities that we mentioned are called patriarchs because of their prominence and because of the control that they held. Large cities, important cities, and as time went on, they came to have more and more official control over the others, so that other clergy looked to them. So you've got these two centers. Then basically you've got Rome and the churches of the West tending to look to the Bishop of Rome. And you have the churches of the East tending to look to Constantinople and the Patriarch there. But they were still, at least until later during this period, they still more or less cooperated together. They would recognize one another. They said that we're basically one Catholic Church. But during this time, we're going to see how a rift came increasingly. Now, we speak of this, the Eastern Church, sometimes as the Byzantine Church, because the old name for Constantinople was Byzantium. And we'll just notice a few things about this church. First of all, we'll mention an emperor that was quite influential. His name is Justinian. And he reigned as emperor from 527 to 565. 527 to 565. And he died in his 80s. And he was a strong man and a capable man. And he had a dream of restoring the Roman Empire. Things were kind of floundering. As Justinian said, he had to form this golden dream to see the Roman Empire restored. He, of course, would be the emperor. And to help this, he wanted unity in the church. He really wanted unity in the church, because the emperors realized if you're having hassles over your religion, you're not really going to be united. They realized religion can unify a people. So if we can get the church united, why, this is going to help. And he had some good generals and some good armies, and he reconquered land they'd lost. Under Justinian, you had Italy reconquered. And you have Spain and North Africa reconquered. And of course, they lost it later to the Muslims, but for a time, there was this revival of strength. Under Justinian, once again, this empire was the mightiest empire on earth. Because the Persian Empire was just very struggling. And India wasn't that strong at this time. And China, later on there came a revival of strength in China. But at this time, under Justinian, this was the strongest empire. And Justinian was orthodox. He stood right behind the Chalcedon Creed. And he was one who wanted to see the church united and beneath there and not to be divided. What was the area that the churches of the East seemed to have lots of problems with? What was the doctrinal error? We talked about this earlier, especially. Do you remember what it was?
Good and evil of the body? No.
Well, that was one area, yes. They were influenced by the dualism. There was a lot of this. Well, I'm thinking here of the area where you have the group called the Monophysites, where they believed Christ had only one nature. That really the body was human, but his spirit, this was all God. He was a God in a human body. He wasn't really human in spirit. The body was simply a robot for the God to use. And so you had some of these areas that were real problems, and Justinian had a desire to see that controversy taken care of and to see the church united in belief. Now, he's quite a builder. Built lots of towns, bridges, loved to build churches, and he built St. Sophia, the cathedral church in Constantinople, a great, beautiful church. Yes, I believe so. St. Sophia. And under him you have the Fifth Ecumenical Council in 553. And this was an attempt to bring unity again. But you still have these churches that believed in this other teaching concerning the nature of Christ persisting. And sometimes these churches persisted with their beliefs because of national differences. They could say, well, you know, we don't want to accept the authority of the bishop in Constantinople. And you have the feelings of nationalism and the idea, well, we can have our own church. We don't have to bow to what they say. Why should we listen to what they say anyway? Who cares what the council up there says? What right do they have to tell us what to do? So there was nationalism mixed with this often in the division and the differences. And of course the mistake that was made was trying to form, you see, just an outward unity. And trying to make a political unity here. The early church never tried this. You could have churches in Rome, you could have churches in Israel, you could have churches in these different places. They were one because of spiritual bonds. They didn't have to all be one under one central authority, which was the tendency you see here. And which only creates division. So you can see the mistake that's being made here in this area. So, under Justinian, there was this attempt to create unity. I'm going to mention a couple other things in connection with this era. You have the outstanding theologian here of the East is John of Damascus. John of Damascus. And he lived around 700 to 750. And he wrote a book called The Fountain of Knowledge. This was his great work. It's called The Fountain of Knowledge. And it's really a systematic theology. In other words, he writes down, he tries to systematize the teaching of the church. And he didn't have any original thought there. He didn't try to. He was just trying to put down and to systematize things that were generally accepted. We'd say it's very orthodox. Very unexciting, very unoriginal, very orthodox. He just went along the line with what would be accepted. But it was well stated, well written, it was comprehensive, and so it was used for many years. Just kind of a standard doctrinal textbook. You want to study theology? Well, read The Fountain of Knowledge by John of Damascus. Now, during this period, too, you have this controversy about icons. You know what an icon is? Tremendous controversy that tore the church here over icons. It doesn't mean too much. Well, no, not relics are different, really. Cheryl. All right, paintings or images. The Greek eikon is an image. It's this which can be seen, an idol, an image. And so there was controversy over this. And this controversy lasted from 726 to 843. It was just especially in around Constantinople and through there. It was something that tore the churches. Strong feeling. Now, those that were against having icons.
I don't understand the use of the icons. Why would it be controversial?
Well, the controversy is, should you have them or shouldn't you? Is it legitimate, see, to have a statue in a church? Or isn't it? Is it a good thing to have a picture of Christ, and to look at it and to, you know, will that help you worship? And so you have a strong feeling. Now, what would be an argument that some would use against it? Alright, idols. Thou shalt make no graven image, the second commandment. Second commandment says no graven images. You've got an idol. Well, the argument of the others would be, well, actually, we're not worshiping the image. See, we're worshiping God, but this is an aid to devotion. This helps me to worship. I see something tangible, and this kindles my devotion, so then I worship. I see a picture of Jesus. Now, you had a strong feeling here in some, especially where there was an emphasis on the deity of Christ, they said, well, you know, you're just emphasizing his humanity. You don't even know what he looked like. And there you got a picture of a man. But on the other hand, those who emphasized his humanity would say, well, you're making him so completely other. I want to see what he looks like a man. Have a picture of him. He was a man, wasn't he? And so you had a real struggle, you see, going on in the church. And in 726, Leo III, who was an emperor, put out an edict against icons. He didn't like them. And they destroyed an image of Christ that was very popular, and they had riots in the city. It was really wild. Leo III was his name, and he was the emperor at that time. And so you have controversy going on. The popes in general supported icons, but you had various emperors that were against them. But finally, in 843, you have it more or less settled. Theodora, who was the regent for her infant son, Michael III, in other words, she was really in charge of the realm at this time, authorized icons. She came out strong for it. And it was interesting, too. Usually women were more in favor of icons than men. Maybe it's the emotional side and so forth. But when they'd have hassles, the women were usually in favor of the images, the men would be against. And this, at least officially, ended the controversy. The emperor came out strong now for icons, it's okay. But there was a difference in the way the Greek and the Latin groups handled it. The Latin church went ahead and hung onto statues, whereas the Greek church as a whole said no statues, just pictures. And this was a difference that has persisted.
That still goes today, doesn't it?
Largely, yes. You'll have pictures in your Greek churches, in your Eastern churches. And you see, flowing from this branch of the church, you have your Russian Orthodox, you have your Syrian Orthodox, you have your Greek Orthodox, all of these different groups that were influenced and carry on many of the traditions. You have monasteries continuing during this period. In the East, the monasteries tended to be more contemplative and more mystic. The idea is you withdraw, you get up in a monastery on the top of a mountain and you think about God and you worship and you withdraw from life. And this tended to be the pattern more for their monasteries. Whereas in the West, you had different kinds. And you had some monasteries and some monks that were very active in social work and they were more practical, maybe, in a lot of their outlook. During this period, you have a lot of hermits, and you have some pillar saints. Does anyone know what a pillar saint is? Yeah, you have different ones. You have one fellow, for example, named Daniel, who lived from 409 to 493. The last 33 years, he lived on top of a pillar in Constantinople. I don't know just how he worked it out. If he had a little tent up there, a little bathroom or outhouse or something up on top of the thing. But the thing is, you're going to show your holiness, you see, by doing something that is hard, that is ascetic, that is depriving. And maybe the thought is you'll get closer to God. If you fell off, you would be, for sure. But anyway, you had these pillar saints who would, they were out in plain view practicing their religion. It's amazing, you know, when you think of what the Lord said about what you do in secret if you're going to do religious acts. But it's hard to imagine anything more of a public display than something like this. Now, just quickly to notice a couple differences between the East and the West. The Latin Church, you had a celibate clergy, you had images, and you hung onto your liturgy in Latin. Latin was the language used in every church. The Greek was more lenient in these areas, the Eastern churches. They had married clergy, still do. They had pictures. They emphasized the liturgy in the vernacular, translated into Slavic, translated into Greek, translated into the language of the people. And so you do have some of those basic differences between these two branches of the church. And we'll look at the Western church more next time.